It is nearly 12 o'clock, and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 54 degrees under overcast skies. Out at the airport, they are showing northeast winds to 5 miles per hour. They have 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service continues to be optimistic about mostly sunny skies for the rest of the day, with a high near 64. Calm winds turning to the east to 5 miles per hour. Coming up on the Midday Report, Kodiak is now a part of the City Health Dashboard. We'll find out what that is and how you can access information there. And PFAS, they've been detected in Unalaska. That and how they're trying to figure out what kind of storm activity coastal Alaska may have in its future. Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Day after being arraigned on charges he conspired to overturn the results of the 2020 election, former President Donald Trump is appearing tonight at a Republican dinner in Alabama. Troy Public Radio's Kyle Gassett reports Trump will be joined in Montgomery by a loyal supporter from the U.S. Senate.
If Trump is looking for a warm welcome following his latest court appearance, Alabama is a good choice. The Republican-dominated state voted overwhelmingly for Trump in the past two elections, and so far has given him the largest share of donations of any candidate in the 2024 presidential race. Senator Tommy Tuberville will introduce Trump to a crowd in Montgomery. Some Trump supporters have paid $50,000 for a table. Alabama's senior senator is holding up military appointments over the Pentagon's abortion policy. Trump has called Tuberville an incredible coach and senator, and in turn, Tuberville has called the former president's indictments a witch hunt. For NPR News, I'm Kyle Gassett in Montgomery, Alabama.
China says it is sending a top official to Saudi Arabia this weekend for talks on Ukraine's peace proposals. NPR's Michelle Kellerman has more.
Saudi Arabia is hosting senior officials from about 40 countries to hear how Ukraine wants this war to end. China says it's sending its special envoy for Eurasian affairs, and in a statement says it's ready to play a constructive role in seeking a political settlement of the Ukraine crisis. Russia was not invited to the meeting in Jeddah, but says Moscow will be watching closely. The U.S. sees this meeting Saturday and Sunday as a chance for Ukraine to spell out its proposals on how to end the war and how to hold Russia to account for its aggression. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
Another victim is being linked to the decade-long investigation into murders on a Long Island beach in New York. During a news conference today, Suffolk County District Attorney Raymond Tierney identified the Jane Doe, whose remains were found in 1996 and again in 2011 near Gilgo Beach.
We are here to announce that as part of the Gilgo Task Force re-examination of all the evidence in the case, we are able to identify Fire Island Jane Doe as Karen Vergata, who was 34 years old at the time of her disappearance.
Today, experts reenacted the 2018 Parkland, Florida mass shooting as part of a lawsuit. Victims' families accuse a former law enforcement official of doing little to protect the students and staff inside. 17 lives were lost. 17 people were injured. Len Neoff, a law professor at the University of Michigan, describes the powerful impact a reenactment can have on a jury.
A reenactment like this is dramatic. It's memorable. If the jurors remember no other piece of evidence, they'll remember this one. And the jurors could place more value on it than it deserves.
The site of the massacre is slated to be demolished. It's NPR.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor llama al 907-481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. Kodiak is now part of an online initiative to make public health data across the country more accessible to local communities. The City Health Dashboard was created by New York University's Medical School, and it includes everything from rates of diabetes to broadband connectivity. More than 900 cities are part of the program, including Kodiak, which came online last month. Alyssa McKenzie is Kodiak's Healthy and Equitable Communities Program Coordinator with the state's Department of Health. She says the dashboard provides a bird's-eye view of Kodiak's public health needs.
It's a good tool to kind of assist with identifying disparities and reducing that disease burden, as well as just health equity burdens that we experience in our community.
The dashboard compiles publicly available data from different sources, like the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the U.S. Census Bureau, all in a centralized location online. And anyone can look up their city through a searchable database. Kodiak is only the second city in the state to join the dashboard. The other is Anchorage. Alaska has unique public health burdens, and McKenzie says rural representation on the dashboard is important.
It'll help not just public health, but our local community-based organizations, as well as city officials, borough officials, to make decisions moving forward about how we can decrease those disparities that exist in our community.
McKenzie says the dashboard is also helpful for members of the public to better understand the place they live. Anyone can check it out by visiting cityhealthdashboard.com. PFAS. The term has been getting a lot of attention lately. They're sometimes called forever chemicals and have been linked to cancer. And recently, the U.S. Geological Survey released a study saying that nearly half of all tap water could have at least one type of the contaminant. In addition, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency recently announced that even small amounts in drinking water may pose serious health risks. And according to a recent report from Unalaska's Department of Public Utilities, the island's drinking water also shows traces of PFAS. Steve Tompkins is the director of public utilities and a self-proclaimed water geek. He says PFAS were detected in one of the city's three wells in really low amounts, 1.25 parts per trillion.
It's a very low level. And if we would have tested at the tap, because we usually run all three wells at the same time and they blend and then they go to the consumer, of course it would have been a non-detect. It would have been below detectants.
There are thousands of different kinds of PFAS, and they're found all over the place in shampoos, firefighting foams, ski wax. They sometimes end up in our drinking water and our bodies where they build up. Until last year, the EPA said negative health effects could occur in water with contamination levels of 70 parts per trillion, but they've since adjusted their advisory to anything above 4. Tompkins says the city isn't required to test the water for PFAS, and the amount they found on the island is so low that it might not have even been detected next time they test. He says it's important to know that forever chemicals are there, but it's also sort of complicated.
It causes more questions than answers because you do wonder, you know, what is in that area.
Well, number two, where the PFAS were found, is located in Unalaska's valley, across from the tribal office. Tompkins says the history of military presence in that area may be the cause of the contamination. Most of the island's water comes from Icy Lake at the Pyramid Water Treatment Plant. There were no PFAS detected there. For now, the city will keep a close eye on the levels. Tompkins says if those numbers get high enough, they'll have to treat the water. Coastal Alaska is on the front lines of climate change. Extreme weather events like Typhoon Murbach that pummeled western Alaska last fall are becoming more common, and many communities along Alaska's shores are wondering if the future will bring more major storms. Chris Mayo is the director of the Arctic Coastal Geoscience Lab at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. His team has spent the last 4 years trying to answer that question, what storms might look like in the future. And they're doing that by looking into the past.
You've often heard that story that the past is the key to the future. And so in geology and understanding coastal changes, that applies too. And so we're really looking into the past through sediment cores.
Sediment cores are cylindrical sections that scientists extract from the bottom of the ocean. They basically insert a long tube into the seafloor and pull out a piece of the earth. And then they can examine the various layers to determine when certain events took place.
And so with that, we can look at both, say, the modern record, say, the last 100 years, and then we can also look hundreds of years into the past and understand how many big storms were occurring each century. Were the storms occurring because of some, regional or global climate changes, some warming events or things like that?
Here's how it works in bays and fjords around the Aleutians. Under normal conditions, the sediment is very fine-grained, like silt or mud. But when a storm comes in, it churns up the ocean and moves in larger sediment. Scientists can see those layers in the core. Then they use carbon dating to find out when those storms happened. Rhys Bogardus has worked on the project from the beginning. He says they're basically creating a timeline into the past.
We're building an archive of storminess, and the crux of the project is to extend our record of storms in the region far beyond the satellite record and the living records of the memories of people. We're trying to get at storminess thousands of years in the past to learn about the future.
The crew recently returned from a trip to Atka Island, where they worked with the local tribe to extract about a dozen cores. Next, they'll ship those samples to the lab for carbon dating. The team is planning another trip to the Aleutians next summer. They hope to complete the final project by 2025. For the first time in 3 years, the Anchorage School District has enough bus drivers to staff all their routes when school starts. At the ASD Transportation Center on Tudor Road yesterday, Superintendent Jarrett Bryant said drivers play a big role in education.
We were in a big transportation crisis last year, and this year is about celebrating the fact that all of our students will have access to transportation this upcoming year.
Over the past 2 years, some drivers chose to drive tour buses during the first part of the school year, leaving the district without enough drivers for each bus route. That left students with no transportation for up to 6 weeks at a time. Bryant says the district did a better job of recruiting this year.
We did increase the wages to be competitive compared to where we were at 2 years ago. And we also offered all of our bus drivers summer employment. So that way they didn't have to think about where they're going to work at outside of ASD.
The summer employment offered to bus drivers involves situational training and bus maintenance. Bus routes will be announced on August 10th for the 23,000 Anchorage students who use district transportation to get to school. The first day of school for Anchorage students is August 17th. Black seaweed is a culturally significant delicacy in southeast Alaska. But in recent years, traditional harvesters say it doesn't look or taste right, and it's difficult to find. Now a regional native nonprofit hopes a new study can help save the harvest. Coast Alaska's Angela Denning reports.
Irene Dundas has harvested black seaweed her whole life, near Cape when she was young and near Ketchikan as an adult. The harvest happens in May, when the seaweed is exactly the right size. Dundas and family members travel by boat to specific large rocks far from shore. It must be low tide so they can pull the seaweed off the rocks.
When you're grabbing it in your handful, it looks like you're grabbing a handful of long, thick black hair.
Black seaweed is found in more treacherous areas. It needs nutrients that only come from lots of moving water. Dundas harvests about 50 gallons to share with family and friends. Processing is lengthy, drying the seaweed into bite-sized pieces.
It kind of was crunchy, like a piece of popcorn. But the flavor is like the black seaweed that you put on sushi. It's that exact flavor.
She transfers the wet seaweed in pillowcases and puts it outside on several large tables to dry. But in the years 2021 and 2022, she noticed something was wrong.
The seaweed had a very, very distinct, strong, strong smell. There was a discoloration, this light green color I felt like it had a little bit more metallic taste to it.
To get any good seaweed this year, she traveled for hours by boat near the Canadian border. Her past harvests, she threw away.
I was alarmed and very, very, very upset. I had no clue what was going on.
This year, I hardly had anything of a harvest.
Kiolani Booth collects black seaweed on the outer waters near Metlakatla and southern Prince of Wales Island.
I usually give out quite a bit to our community members that can't go out. And I was only able to get a minute amount, and it was kind of heartbreaking because, you know, some of these people depend on me to bring them some seaweed for the year.
Booth says black seaweed could be like a canary in a coal mine, a warning of what could come from climate change.
It's a very hard seaweed to try to cultivate. It's very sensitive, which, you know, you realize that in the open ocean, it's a precursor to all the things that are stronger in the ocean.
The Metlakatla tribe got a grant to start researching the problem 2 years ago. That research is ongoing, and last month, Dundas and Booth carried their concerns to a meeting in Juneau, hosted by the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. Harvesters and scientists discussed what to do. Jennifer Clark from Vancouver brought a Western science perspective. She works for a kelp company, but studied the effects of climate change on seaweed for her PhD. In a postdoctoral project, she worked with indigenous groups in central British Columbia about black seaweed disappearing there.
In 2016, it's almost completely missing from the intertidal shoreline.
Clark's research linked the disappearance to an enormous hot water mass in the northern Pacific known as the Blob. In 2014 and 2015, the blob moved from the Gulf of Alaska down to California. It was followed by more heat from El Nino, which elevated seawater 1 to 2 degrees, enough to destroy the black seaweed.
These heat waves are just kind of unprecedented. They just cause disruptions in life cycles and disturbances in the intertidal, which most of the seaweeds that you find are intertidal subtidal, so they're getting extreme changes in their habitat.
She learned that black seaweed couldn't survive past 64 degrees. As temperatures cooled in the years after the blob and El Nino double whammy, BC seaweed started to come back, but not like before. Clark doesn't know if Alaska's black seaweed problem was also affected by the blob. She says it would take more research, but she does know that black seaweed anywhere has challenges ahead if climate predictions come true.
I think if it was persistent, like if we were to increase 2 degrees, 2050, I think that's the projection is 1.5 degrees, then maybe they won't be so resilient and they'll just kind of exist as much as they can until they're wiped out.
Black seaweed is, you know, really important to us as a food source, but also for its cultural components.
Rosita Worrell is the president of Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. She says the seaweed is critical to many communities in and out of Alaska because it's shared and traded.
It's like a glue that binds our community together through our widely sharing patterns. And then the other important thing, it also has spiritual dimensions. Black seaweed is distributed and consumed during our ceremonies.
Sea Alaska Heritage Institute is creating a committee comprised of harvesters and scientists to start studying the problem. They're also documenting the historical practices of the harvest and how it's changed in recent years. They hope the information will help them figure out if there's any way to save black seaweed. Reporting for Coast Alaska, in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Hundreds gathered on Friday night last week in Haines to watch Juno Drag's first ever appearance at the Southeast Alaska State Fair. Despite the initial controversy over the performance, KTOO's Yvonne Crumrie reports that the show was an overwhelming hit.
Volunteers in purple vests and fairy wings set up the catwalk as people of all ages crowd around the stage, many wearing glitter on their faces. For some residents, like Cimarron Marquardt, hosting a drag show at the fair is a sign that Haines is a safe place for queer people.
For me personally, as a mother, it allows my transgender daughter to see people who represent her as a person in a town that's not very diverse. So I'm really excited that the fair didn't cancel it.
There was some controversy leading up to Friday's show. When fair organizers posted the lineups in March, they got nearly 100 emails about the drag show, mostly in support. But some parents expressed concerns about kids being exposed to drag and what they thought would be sexual themes. Another person implied that drag should be met with violence. But in May, fair officials announced they would not cancel the show. Instead, they'd move it from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. For Hainsborough Assembly member Ben Altman Moore, the show means that the town is catching up with the rest of the world.
And also, Haines is very concerned about keeping it to young people. And this is the kind of thing where young people are like, okay, it's not 1954 anymore.
Juno Drag has had a large presence in Juneau and Skagway, but nobody KTOO spoke to could remember a drag show in Haines before. The acts range from tributes to Stevie Nicks and Barbie to a Where's Waldo parody. Drag artist Latoya Hart Monroe has been performing for nearly a decade. She says the group wanted to make the show suitable for all ages, and she wishes she had exposure to drag when she was growing up in Juneau.
I didn't have access to anything like this when I was a kid, and I really do wonder, like, how that would have changed how I move around in the world and how I see myself.
The show may be the most attended at the fair this year. When the very tall Lamia Monroe steps on stage in a classic Barbie chevron swimsuit, teen girls at the front scream and cheer. Later, Luke the Duke of Bell does a modern country medley, and when Gigi Monroe walks out as Stevie Nicks, it's the team's moms who lose their minds.
Did you enjoy our teens and teens tonight?
The show goes until about 11 p.m. After a curtain call, dozens line up to have their photos taken with the performers. Reporting from Haines, I'm Yvonne Cormarie.
The labor market is slowing, but it's still tight. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer with the Marketplace Minute. 187,000 new jobs were created last month, fewer than expected. The unemployment rate came in at 3.5%. Wages were up 4.4% over last year, outpacing inflation. The Federal Reserve is trying to beat back prices with higher interest rates. The wage bump could lead the Fed to raise rates again to discourage consumers from spending and heating up the economy. Amazon and Airbnb reported second quarter revenue above expectations. Amazon cut thousands of jobs and says sales of Amazon cloud services were up. Airbnb was able to raise prices because of the travel boom. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer with the Marketplace Minute.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Friday. It is the fourth day of August, the year 2023. The sun rose today at 6:10. It will set again at 10:19. That will give us 16 hours and 9 minutes of glorious daylight, a loss of 4 minutes and 21 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record low for this date was 39 degrees set in 1973, and our record high was 78 degrees set in 1983. Currently 56 degrees under overcast skies. Out at the airport, they are showing northeast winds to 3 miles per hour, and they have 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service continues to insist that we will have mostly sunny skies this afternoon with a high near 64. Calm winds turning to the east to 5. Partly cloudy overnight with a low around 49. South winds to 5 becoming southwest after midnight. And they're calling for partly sunny skies tomorrow with a high near 61 and calm winds turning to the southeast to 5 tomorrow morning. For Sunday, just a 50% chance of rain and a high likelihood of rain starting on Monday and going through Tuesday. Let's check in with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Hello, this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Kodiak with Kodiak Commercial Salmon Fishery Advisory Announcement number 25, date issued 10 a.m. on August 2nd. There will be a 57-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Friday, August 4th to 9 p.m. Sunday, August 6th in the following areas. In the outer Karluk and Halibut Bay sections of the southwest Kodiak District, the northwest Kodiak District, except for the Uyak Bay and inner Uganic Bay sections, will remain closed. The northeast Kodiak District, the east side Kodiak District, closed waters at Sulphur Creek Stream number 259-415 will be the normal closed waters as described in regulation. The Cape Alatak, Humpy Dead Man, Owl Attack Bay, Mosier Bay, and Olga Bay sections of the Owl Attack District, the Duck Bay, southeast of Frognac, southwest of Frognac, northwest of Frognac, Raspberry Strait, and northeast of Frognac sections of the Frognac District, and the Mainland District. Cost recovery fisheries are scheduled to begin in Katoy Bay Special Harvest Area on August 5th, and fishing opportunities in the Duck Bay, Iziut Bay, Inner Katoy Bay, and Outer Katoy Bay sections will depend on the ability of the Regional Aquaculture Association to meet cost recovery needs, and all cost recovery information can be obtained by calling 486-6559. As previously announced, the following areas will close to commercial salmon fishing at 9 p.m. Thursday, August 3rd. The Inner Katoy Bay, Outer Katoy Bay, and Iziut Bay sections of the Frognac District. And closed waters in Inner Katoy Bay will be the fishing game markers located at Little Katoy and Big Katoy Bays near stream numbers 252, 323, and 252, 324 until 9 p.m. Thursday, August 3rd. The Spiridon Bay Special Harvest Area remains open until further notice. And until further notice, within the Kodiak area, only that portion of the northwest and southwest Kodiak district south of the latitude of Cape Kuliak, king salmon 28 inches or greater in length may not be retained by purse hand gear in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. Other closed waters are shown in the Kodiak area salmon statistical chart and detail in the commercial salmon fishing regulations. And statistical charts, harvest strategies, and commercial salmon fishing regulations are available at the Kodiak Fish and Game office. And, of course, the most recent salmon fishery information may be obtained by calling the department's 24-hour recorder phone at 486-4559. Thank you very much. Good luck fishing. And this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
We have a high tide coming up at 5:08 this afternoon here on the east side. That will be 8.6 feet, followed by a low tide at 10:53 p.m. of 6/10. Over on the west side, your high tide will happen at 5:33 this afternoon and be 14.7 feet in Larsen Bay, followed by a low tide at 11:37 of 8/10. Mariners, here's your forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 nautical miles. Variable 10 for today, tonight, and tomorrow. 2-foot seas today, coming up to 3 feet tomorrow. Over in the Shelikof Strait, south 15 for today and tonight, and 3-foot seas. East 15 tomorrow, with seas to 3 feet. You can meet Anchorage-based artist John Eppard and fish and wildlife biologist Sarah Merkgaard. That's happening at the Kodiak Refuge Visitor Center tonight between 5 and 7 p.m. The refuge will also have art activities for youth and adults, sticker giveaways, art from dozens of local artists on display, and light refreshments. Sounds like a good time. That's tonight, 5 to 7 p.m. at the Kodiak Refuge Visitor Center downtown.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the midday report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.
The following are upcoming Kodiak Island Borough public meetings. On Wednesday, August 9th, the Planning and Zoning Commission will be having their regular work session in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. On Thursday, August 10th, the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly will be having a work session in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. All meetings are open to the public, and meeting packets are available on the Kodiak Island Borough website. Contact the Borough Clerk's Office at 907-486-9310 with any questions. The declaration
stands. Hello, Kodiak, and welcome to the August 4th edition of Island Byways. I'm Pam Foreman. One thing you can say about Kodiak, when the weather finally changes for the good, it really comes through. Sunny days mixed with flat, calm water led to kayaking adventures for many. Others chose to hit the trails and hike the mountains. Whatever your favorite outdoor activity, most of us managed to get out over the past week and take advantage of the good days. Did we have a little moisture one or two days? Sure we did. Did we have some fog? Sure we did. But didn't that make for some magical landscapes and experiences? Living in Kodiak, you soon learn to enjoy the experience, no matter what the weather. But when the weather turns out to be beautiful, it makes the island that much easier to love. The finks are here, and there are reports of some silvers being caught, too. Take the kids and yourselves out for some fun fishing the finks along the beaches and riverbanks, and enjoy that bounty. Have you ever wondered what that trail on the backside of Old Woman's Mountain is like? Well, Saturday is a great time to find out on the Audubon hike up that trail to the lakes. The hike up Old Woman's is rated a number 4 in difficulty on a scale from 1 to 5, with 1 being the easiest. It's about 6.5 miles round trip with a 1,400-foot elevation gain. Sunday's Audubon hike is up Kashevaroff Mountain. That's rated a number 5 in difficulty at about 6.4 miles round trip and a 2,200-foot gain in elevation. Meet at the ferry terminal downtown at 9:30 a.m. on the appropriate day to join either hike. Wear layers, bring water, and a snack for both hikes. And that's it for Island Byways this week. Have fun and stay safe out there. Thanks for listening.